You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. My name is Moises Naim. I'm a senior associate at in the International Economics Department at Carnegie. I welcome you very much to our conversation today. It is a very important topic for which there is much to say, and there is many different views and perspectives. To discuss them with you and amongst themselves, we have assembled what I think is an extraordinary panel. I start with Georges Descressins. He's assistant director at the IMF Research Department. I will not read the details of their very accomplished careers. You have them with you. Then Philip Suttle. He's the chief economist at the Institute for International Finance. Follow him is Hans Timmer, the director at the World Bank Development Prospects Group, and Desmond Lachman, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Uri Dadush, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the leader of the International Economics Program. Welcome you all, and thank you for being here. Let me start with you, Georg, about a framing question concerning how to reconcile what needs to be done now with what needs to be done to have sustainable, stable growth in the future. Is there a contradiction between measures that gear to stabilize the economy and renew growth that is stable now with the goal of having long-term stable growth?
Moses, I think fundamentally there is no big contradiction here. Let me first start to give you an overview of where we see the global economy, what needs to be done, and then I'll explain the absence of a contradiction in that context. The global economy is already on the mend. I mean, it's still a very slow and sluggish recovery, but it's actually quite robust in many emerging economies, and where it is slow and sluggish is in the advanced economies, so right here. But even here, you've seen some reasonably good data, at least relative to our forecasts, you know, for the third quarter for the US and also for Japan, although there are some temporary elements there. And even in the euro area, in spite of all the financial uncertainty and stress, which certainly has been bigger than what we expected, the numbers keep coming in more or less as we, the Commission, or the ECB expected. So there is some resiliency in this recovery. But the bottom line is it's not yet generating enough jobs, and that's the key concern at this juncture. So we need a more robust recovery, especially in the advanced economies. And that's where the policies come in and where we need to address both the short-term and the medium-term requirements. I'll give you an example where there could be a contradiction. It's, for example, on fiscal policy, right? I mean, we all understand that in many advanced economies, we need to fiscally consolidate over the medium term. We have a problem related to aging populations coming at us, right? But at the same time, there is a need to support recovery. We also have in some countries financial pressures that make it difficult to support the economy, so they militate one way, although given their weaknesses, you would still actually like to have some fiscal support. Now, how do you reconcile this? One way to reconcile this is actually that you do stimulate in the short run, but you do implement reforms now that impact future spending. For example, you have a stimulus now, and you raise retirement ages in line with life expectancy over the next 30 years. So that's a way where you bring down future deficits, and that gives you space to give more stimulus today. That's one way to reconcile it. The other way, the other important element in terms of building a stronger recovery is the banking system. Here, what do we want over the medium term? We do want a safer financial system in the medium term that continues to support growth. In the short term, this requires that there be changes. Banks need to hold more capital, higher capital ratios. Funding, the nature of funding needs to change from wholesale funding a little bit more towards retail funding. And all of this takes time. And in the meantime, there's, of course, the risk that banks just simply deleverage or, you know, just don't give as many loans anymore so that relative to capital, they're looking stronger to the regulators. And that's where I think, again, there's a role for government coming in terms of helping banks to recapitalize where this is needed.
And that's a very aggregate view, right? Because you would agree that there are very important regional differences. And that some of the things that you are stating apply more to some regions than others, right? And let me use that as to bring in Desmond to the conversation, because I think I think you would disagree with some of the things. You published today in the New York Times an article called "A European Economic Tsunami," where essentially you predict that it's going to be impossible for Europe to keep the euro, and at least that the periphery countries cannot hold on to the euro. If that's the case, in George's description, there were no talk of exchange rates. There was fiscal consolidation, and there was the banking financial sector reforms, right?
I agree. That's because you seem to but that's okay. That's
true. Had I let him continue, he would have mentioned something about exchange rates, to be fair. So, but I want you to talk about exchange rates and about the euro. And do you agree on the notion that it's possible to reconcile, or probable that we will be able to reconcile in the euro area, short-term measures and long-term stability?
Let me just start by saying that I find the IMF outlook, you know, way too sanguine. You know, that I would see two basic themes that are really going to affect the global economy in 2011. The first is that the United States recovery is a very weak recovery, and there's very little prospect that that recovery is going to be strong going forward. You know, what you've got is you've got the fading of the fiscal stimulus package, you've got a housing crisis that still has to play itself out, you've got unemployment at close to 10%, no wage growth. So we've got a very anemic U.S. recovery at best. You know, and possibly you can even see a slower U.S. growth outlook going forward. But for me, what is the real issue in 2011 is the way in which this crisis in Europe's periphery is going to play out. And the point that I would emphasize is that it's not a problem of the periphery, but it's rather a problem for the European banking system. That what we're talking about here is $2 trillion in sovereign debt at the periphery that is mainly held by the German, the French, the UK, and so on banks. And if we've got to write down that debt, as we're certainly going to have to, that means that European banking system is going to be taking a big hit. And I think that this is, in my view, this is rather inevitable, you know, because what you've got is you've got a situation where four countries, you know, and I'm referring, of course, to Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain, have developed very large imbalances, both with respect to the budget, in the case of Spain, with respect to its balance of payments. You know, got far too much external debt. It's got a real balance of payments problem, but stuck within the fixed exchange rate system, all that they can do is tighten policies, which then induces deep recessions. So at some point, this has to give. You know, it can either give, I like to see it in two ways in which this endgame can occur. It either occurs from the top, in which case the German taxpayer just says, enough of this bailout nonsense. You know, we've bailed out Greece, we've bailed out Ireland, we've now got to bail out Portugal. Now they're asking us to bail out Spain. Is it indefinite what we've got to bail out? That, I think, is not the way in which it unravels, even though that is a distinct possibility. Just looking at what happened in Westphalia, for instance, where the German taxpayers handed Merkel a big defeat. I think it's far more likely to occur the way in which it occurred in Argentina, is that the islands or the Greeks say that this is absurd, you know, that recessions where output has dropped in Ireland already 12%, when it drops by 20%, are they still going to go on with saying, you know, we don't need to restructure the debt and we don't need to do the euro? So the euro doesn't really have to fall apart. You don't have to have the exit. All you've got to have is write down on the debts for you to have a severe crisis in the European banking system, much like we had, you know, with Lehman. You know, Bernanke used to talk about the housing market being just a small part of the U.S. economy. Relax, don't worry about it. The connection that you've got to make is that it's the European banks that come into play. That's why, you know, and I'm pretty sure that this will occur by the end of 2011, if not before.
So Desmond Lachman thinks that the IMF view is too sanguine, and he has quite a pessimistic outlook for the Europe's periphery.
I prefer if you qualified my outlook as a realistic outlook.
Would any of you be willing to take a realistic outlook but tending towards the more optimistic side? Would anybody would like to disagree with Desmond and provide an alternative view of how things may evolve, that it does not involve a semi-crash of the euro, because you will call it a semi-crash of the euro, right?
I think that my view is that the euro unravels. But it might take a little bit longer than 2011. What I do think occurs is that you get restructuring of the debt before the euro crashes.
Okay,
but the euro
so
will crash.
I'm calling for volunteers to take issue with that perspective. Go ahead, please.
I think there is no inconsistency in, first, the observation, and that's not just an outlook, it's an observation, that the global economy is in much better shape now than it was 2 years ago. And at the same time, the realization that the mood of the policymakers is much more sour now than it was 2 years ago. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the reason is that there are different parts in the world that have different problems now. That is, the point was made in the leader of The Economist this week. So that it's not that easy to have a coordinated approach. There's a lot of tensions bubbling up now. There are some countries that want to grow at the expense of other countries. While 2 years ago, it was all pretty clear. Everybody wanted to stimulate the global economy. Everybody wanted to prevent the mistakes of the Great Depression. To some extent, they succeeded, preventing a trade war. You had coordinated action in the stimulus. You had coordinated nation among central banks, the swaps of the currencies. That is much more difficult now. But I think there's even a more important one, and that is the realization that the problems that have to be tackled now are much more difficult than the problems 2 years ago. 2 years ago, to a large extent, it was a cyclical problem that had to be addressed with very aggressive measures. But as we said, probably all of us, 2 years ago, that crisis would reveal all kinds of structural problems and would create by itself all kinds of structural problems. And at some point, you had to start address those structural problems. And that is the point where the policymakers are now. They have to tackle structural problems that are much more difficult to identify and to solve. And my impression is they are pushing it to the next year and then the next year and the next year because they don't know how to deal with it.
Thank you, Hans Timmer. Hans is, as you know, the director of the World Bank's development prospects. He's in charge of all the effort the bank has in looking forward in the world economy. Phil, you work very closely with the private sector bank. You are at the Institute for International Finance, which is, as we know, it's a group that brings together all of the big banks in the world. What's the mood there? And where do you think they stand in this conversation?
Well, I think the central, as Desmond pointed out, the central, especially in the European framework. I think what I would emphasize about the banking community is it's rather a mirror image of the global economy. Is there's a set of banks who used to be king of the castle who are now not looking so good, and there's a set of banks who were previously even ignored generally, who are now in the ascendant, and I'm specifically talking about the banks in the emerging economies. And that's something maybe we can come back to, but certainly something not to lose sight of, and by the way, an important source of vigor and dynamism in the global economy. But I think what I would emphasize is that everything that we're talking about here, a lot of it comes back to the problems that the banking sector faces in deleveraging. I mean, when we talk about this deleveraging wave going through the global economy, but especially in Europe, one has to recognize that at the heart of it, we're talking about banking sector balance sheets and the challenge of reducing those. And one of the ironies of much of the regulatory reform proposals that Jorg mentioned a few moments ago is I think they intensify tremendously a whole set of of these near-term adjustments. So we're basically shooting ourselves in the foot dramatically by trying to ramp up these measures of regulatory reform. And what the official sector, I think, misses, what they kind of have argued is, well, we can propose things, but we're not going to implement them for 8 years or 5 years or 4 years. Now, unfortunately, the market, and I'm not talking about the market as far as the banks are concerned, but the market as far as investors are concerned, investors basically say, are you there today? And they're increasingly saying that. And, of course, banks then have a competition amongst themselves to get there today. So, unfortunately, all of the deleveraging processes, if anything, have become accelerated. And the final point I'd add here is that, you know, one of the important regulatory changes is to force banks to hold a lot more safe liquid assets. What do they represent? Well, they represent actually government debt in many cases.
Bottom line, you have a sense that the regulatory reforms that have either been in place or have been adopted are pro-cyclical in terms of deepening the crisis and not really...
Dramatically so, and then I think picking up on Desmond's point that this Europeans... I think the point about the European sovereign crisis I would emphasize is we're beyond the point where people don't trust Greece or Ireland. In fact, ironically, people probably trust Greece now. But the problem is they don't trust everyone else who holds Greek paper. So no one wants to be first in to buy Greek paper. If you're given a dollar back from the European authorities to redeem your Greek paper, you're going to take it very eagerly because you know there's a whole set of other investors, basically banks, who are so underwater, not just on Greek paper, but on Spanish paper, Irish paper, Italian paper, who knows, Belgian. The whole thing is such a problem. And I think all the... And by the way, I would emphasize that on top of everything we're seeing out of Basel, the Europeans themselves are adding woes. And on top of that, we have this new acronym, which is the most dangerous acronym out there, which is G-SIFI. If you don't know what G-SIFI is, learn it fast, because it's going to bring down the global system.
Tell us what it is.
A G-SIFI is a globally, systemically important financial institution. And the mandate is to go and get G-SIFIs and make them not G-SIFIs anymore, which is to dramatically...
How many of those are there?
Well, it's interesting. We don't really know, but there's probably at least 50 out there.
Uri Dadush from the Carnegie Endowment, you have been writing recently about Europe and its predicament. Give us a sense, given what you have heard, a perspective from the banks that the regulatory framework is countercyclical, a potential crash of the euro, or the euro in the and the periphery and everything else. What's your sense? And give us a context from where you come from on all this.
Okay, thanks, Moises. I have to give you a health warning that when Desmond Lachman says that he's realistic, you have to keep in mind that he's extremely realistic, meaning he's extremely pessimistic. So I share a lot of the concerns about the Eurozone. We have been saying now for close to a year that this is a very serious situation. However, I steer away from Desmond's very strong conclusion that we're headed towards necessarily an unraveling of the euro area. And that's essentially for two reasons. One is that there is a lot still that Europeans need to do and can do to contain the current crisis. We actually, in my view, have not seen the end game or the full game of what European governments can do. The Germans are very reluctant to undertake all the steps that are necessary. I could go through a long list. But their reluctance also has to be understood in the context of strong political opposition at home, and the fact that they, in a sense, need the crisis to get worse before they go further, whether that further means a much larger European Financial Stability Fund, or whether it means giving more support to liquidity operations and government bond purchases by the European Central Bank. But I think more is coming in that direction if the crisis escalates further. And I think that will happen. The other reason I'm less pessimistic than Desmond is that I do not equate restructuring necessarily with, you know, massive banking collapses. As we know, there are many ways, and in fact, you organized an event on this at the American Enterprise Institute recently. There are ways to do the restructuring which are more elegant than others. And so, for example, a restructuring of Greek debt, which I believe, like Desmond, is inevitable, virtually inevitable, possibly a restructuring of Irish debt, can take the form of a very long-term rescheduling of the debt with lower interest rates, much lower interest rates than the market, and would allow the banks that are holding this debt, perhaps even with some regulatory forbearance, not to recognize, you know, significant losses. And this could be done elegantly. It could even perhaps be coupled with a partial guarantee of the rescheduled debt by an expanded European Financial Stability Fund. Finally, let me say that the reason that I have this somewhat less pessimistic view is simply the realization that a collapse of the euro area is an Armageddon scenario. It's an Armageddon scenario for Europe, and it would also have very, very far-reaching implications for the global economy.
I have a hard time differentiating between your two realisms. Let me go back in the hope of finding some fresh air. Go back to the IMF. Who would have said, right? I interrupted you when you were going to make the third point after the fiscal consolidation points and the financial points. Then it would have been fair to give you a chance to talk about exchange rate, but I wanted first to get in the tsunami scenario here. Tell us about that and see what is your reply to investments.
That many in the markets and some here are underestimating the commitment of the Europeans to the project of the euro. And especially, I think, the commitment of the Germans. I mean, I'm German myself, just as a matter of transparency here, but let me explain this to you. There was a lot of concern about the approval of the Greek package, and it's true, the opposition parties in Germany voted against it. They voted against it for one simple reason, which was they felt that the private sector ought to participate, not because they didn't want to help the Greek. That's very important. Now, it's true. There were bad feelings in the German press. You could see it relative to the Greeks. I should say the Greek government or whichever way you want to put this. And these were partly rooted in the fact that, you know, there had been a number of surprises on statistics and other things that are difficult to swallow for many, especially perhaps in Germany. With Ireland, not a beep. The program was approved like this. And there is a strong, I mean, both the government and the opposition are strongly committed to European solidarity. I mean, it's there. We don't have a Euroskeptical party in Germany. It doesn't exist. You have them in many other European countries, but not in Germany. So there is a very strong commitment there. Now, the situation in Europe remains very uncertain. Absolutely, that is clear. It is, for the moment, not as bad as it was in March, May, June. It may well get worse. It probably will get worse than it is right now. Who knows? But don't underestimate the dedication of the European leadership and many of the European people to this project. And Europe has responded. I mean, it takes a long time. I mean, you're talking about sharing, you know, sharing $500 billion across countries, right? I mean, it's a burden-sharing agreement across countries. It's something that is really hard to implement normally. They pulled it off within a year. Now, these things being hard to implement, it means the processes take time. So there is going to be a period of uncertainty here. There also should be a period of uncertainty because spreads, I think, in a new normal will have to be wider. You know, this is all, the market will have to find its own way. So this is going to be a turbulent period. And there are no two ways about it. Exchange rates. That's very important. The third element of what I wanted to bring in is global rebalancing, right? I mean, we have the strong growth already in many emerging economies, not Eastern Europe, but everywhere else. And then this weak growth in many advanced economies. And, you know, coming out of this crisis, many emerging economies look stronger than they looked before. They've shown resilience, and they're showing significant growth right now. And that is consistent with exchange rate appreciation. And we're seeing that happening, except that it's happening too much in one continent and too little in another continent, right? And that is something that needs to be addressed.
Which continent, sorry?
Okay, well, too much.
So since they are six,
it's totally obvious, you know. Perhaps a bit too much in.
He just wants you to say it.
Perhaps too much in Latin America and too little in Asia.
Asia, okay. So let's.
Continue with the notion that there is this strong commitment in Europe to sustain the euro and to sustain, in fact, the European project. There is no doubt that the collapse of the euro will be a terrible blow to the European project writ large. So one immediate test about that is the support that we will see to the Juncker-Tremonti idea. This is, as you know, these are the finance ministers of Belgium and Italy, and they have proposed that instead of every national government issuing their bonds, they propose the issuance of an e-bond, a European bond. So when a country, the market attacks one country, it in fact is going to deal with the whole European community's bond market. They propose to cap that at about 40%. Each country will get about 40% of GDP. In terms of the bonds, and if you add all of that, that means that you can have a European bond, that is the market, that is the size of U.S. Treasuries. So we're talking about a big deal, and some observers think that that could be a very strong signal, a very strong measure, both to defend the euro, to defend and stabilize Europe, and in fact to stabilize the world economy. Phil, what do banks think about that?
Well, I mean, banks are always big on financial innovation, so I'm sure we've got lots of our,
yes.
lots of our members.
Who, so we have who, seen, yes.
Who love the idea. I think, you know, if I can come at it more as an analyst rather than I think, you know, what we need to recognize, and I think we would all as economists sitting here recognize, is the euro. Well, maybe there's difference in degrees of how we'd state it, but essentially the euro will have a hard time functioning as a single currency without a much stronger degree of fiscal integration. And how you do that is obviously there's various ways of coming at it. The problem I have with the way Europeans often do things, and I think the e-bond's another good example of this, is rather than facing up to the reality, they sort of try and do it through the back door or try and sneak it in and do something that is constitutionally a huge change, but say, well, it's really just a nice project. You know, we'll do this project and then we'll move on. I think where we are now, and probably where Uri and Desmond differ, is their sort of belief on whether we can deliver on European fiscal integration. And I think if you think the euro is going to be sustained, and I, you know, probably as a Brit would reluctantly, but probably say yes, they do have the commitment to do this. I think the corollary is you've got to expect more fiscal integration. I'm just not sure the smart way is to do it from the bottom up, forcing it via the financing route.
Thank you, Phil. People do believe and have argued that this adoption of a European bond is a first step into fiscal in European fiscal integration, and as we know, that will be a welcome development and so on. Uri, you have views on this?
Yeah, I think the This idea of the E-bond is what I had in mind as the kind of nuclear option that is sitting in the background if the situation really deteriorates beyond a certain point. And it is a nuclear option because 40 or 50% of European GDP is a fund that is, what, $6 trillion or something like that, okay? And also the way it was proposed by Tremonti and Juncker has a lot of flexibility in terms of being able to lend even more money than 50% of GDP to a country that was under was under threat. So that is the nuclear option. Now, the biggest, though, impediment to that idea going forward is, again, we come back to the issue of moral hazard, huge moral hazard that would be implied by this institution. And that is why, and I think very understandably so, the Germans and the Austrians and the Dutch are extremely reluctant to move forward on this idea within the current context, because it's very simple. I mean, if you had something like that, then frankly, the pressure is off. We know how difficult these reforms are in Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Italy. The pressure is off Tremonti and others to undertake the very difficult reforms that are needed. That is a fundamental issue, and also helps understand why the German insistence on the sovereign debt restructuring mechanism. Because the sovereign debt restructuring mechanism, together with the new normal of markets that are very discriminating between countries, is in fact an enormous deterrent on both the private sector and the public sector to basically a free ride. So the nuclear option may happen. It will happen in extreme circumstances, and it will only happen accompanied by a sovereign debt restructuring mechanism.
Desmond, imagine that it does happen. Assume a can opener, right? Assume that it will happen. Will that ally your fears of or hopes for an euro collapse?
That, you know, if we prepare to make the assumption that Germany is prepared to write a blank check, however large that check has to be, you know, sure, you can keep this afloat. You know, if the ECB chooses, like it's doing right now, lending 80% of GDP to Ireland, you know, 80% of Ireland's GDP, they're lending 130 billion euros to that country. You know, if they keep printing dough, you know, this can keep going on. But, you know, that's not, I don't think that that's a realistic way.
I think there's a structural permanent impediment for the euro to be sustained.
Well, it's just a question that you've got to ask the Germans to pick up the bill, you know, to be writing a blank check. And that is just not happening. You know, that I think Merkel is making it very clear that she's got no intention of increasing the size of this EFSF. That what, as a result, you know, and this is very important from a market dynamic point of view, is the Europeans are always behind the crisis. They're never getting ahead of the crisis. You know, that really what you want to do is to have a big war chest. You know, they thought that they were getting ahead of the crisis with this $1 trillion that they put together. You know, markets figured out that it was nowhere near $1 trillion. Markets also figured out that if Spain comes into play, you're going to need huge amount, you know, very much more than the $1 trillion. And Merkel, I think, has got clear domestic political constraints, either from the point of view of the voters in Germany or from the Constitutional Court. And what she is doing is shooting down all of these proposals that could compromise the strength of the euro. You know, so I just don't see this. You know, it's, one could think about it, but I don't think it's productive. If I could just say one point, you know, just to respond on the debt restructuring, I think that it's important to get that into perspective, the size of debt restructuring that would be required. You know, so little gimmicks like strengthening, you know, pushing out the maturities are difficult to do when you've got to be writing down debt by 50%, 70%, as you're going to have to do, you know, in the Irish and the Greek cases.
Thank you, Desmond. Hans Timmer, any views on this, especially on the euro bond?
Yeah, on the euro bond, I think it's not only a question that the Germans would have to pay the bill because they guarantee the debt, but they would have to pay the future bill also of higher borrowing costs, and that's some of the concerns in Northern Europe at the moment mm-hmm. that pushes against this idea. But for the sake of debate,
the panel, I want to just show hands. Is the euro bond not going to happen?
Well, what's your time frame?
1 year.
1 year?
No, I
don't. Not happen.
Probably the Eurobond is not happening in 1 year.
Well, my answer is it depends. I mean,
come on. Thank you.
It doesn't happen in 1 year if the euro is not in danger of imminent collapse. If the euro becomes in danger of imminent collapse,
then it's your nuclear.
I think it's the nuclear option. There are other nuclear options, by the way, but that's one of them.
So the priority should be to fix up the banking system. We have stress tests coming up now. They offer an opportunity to really take the pulse of the banking system, and then governments will have to. Then one has to make a calculation how much money will have to be put into the banking system. And
maybe
then move from there.
There's no time for that. Maybe that the markets are moving at a speed and reacting.
I think the tests are planned for over the next few months, and there is time. It could be. I mean, you know, it's a very uncertain world, but, you know, you don't want to operate under that assumption.
Right.
I mean, you have to have a reasonable assumption. You can't rush stress tests, you know. Can't pull a rabbit out of a hat.
I will give you a chance, but I would like also to give a chance to the audience. And so raise your hands, and I think we have microphones. Around and while we get the microphones to let me start in the back. The gentleman was first there, but before, let me take Hans. You wanted to say something, Hans?
Yeah, for the sake of debate, I wanted to react to something that Phil said. He said banks like innovations. Banks are also very good in not liking changes that are actually needed. And I think your first intervention pointed at that. And that's exactly what you're seeing with a lot of policymakers at the moment, not being ready to implement the changes that are really needed. And if you go back to what caused the crisis, that is what happened during the boom before the crisis. So you had over-leveraging in the banking sector. You had those global systemic risk coming from the banking sector. You probably had too loose monetary policy. And what you're seeing now happening in the banking sector, they say, because of the cyclical situation, we can't move there, and even you can't develop the plan for the longer run. And the policymakers say the only thing that is left is even looser monetary policy. Now, when you look from developing countries, and that's what we do a lot, where they have become the drivers of growth, they are the stable force now, they see that happening. And they end up with the instability created by these kind of reactions. Now you had the capital flows going to Brazil, going to South Africa, going to Turkey. In the second quarter, suddenly $400 billion in short-term debt showed up in China. So these kind of policies, they create a lot of nervousness in the development world.
Absolutely.
Phil, would you like briefly to reply to him, or...?
Well, no, I think he's raised a very important point, but what I would emphasize is banks are very fast to react, and the problem is here you've got various different ways to react which have different outcomes for the economy, and we would all like, I think, banks to react in a way that's growth supportive, but at the moment they're being encouraged strongly to react very quickly in a way that's, I think, collectively undermining growth.
Thank you. The gentleman over there, please.
Although a number of people...
Can you raise and tell us who you are and where are you?
I'm Bernard Wasso of the Century Foundation. A number of the speakers have mentioned developing countries or regions generically. I haven't heard the word China, I think, mentioned at all. And I looked at 2007, the eve of the crisis. At that time, the United States was issuing about 50% of the total current account deficit of the world, current account deficit countries. Three countries were the big lenders, and the biggest of those was China. Now, we've heard that the second was Germany, the third was Japan. Japan has 200% debt to GDP ratio, internal debt. Germany isn't going to do anything politically. China, which could become a large source of aggregate demand for the rest of the world if they adjusted their exchange rate seems to me a missing piece of this discussion.
Thank you very much. There are many hands, so why don't you take notes of the... Let me take several questions. Take notes and then respond to the best you can to most of the questions. I think I have somebody in the back or... Now that you're there, go ahead, and then you.
Thank
then.
You. Barry Wood, economics correspondent. Three elements, please. Phil, when you say that too much regulation is a problem, this is counterintuitive. Most people are of the view that we got into this trouble because we didn't have enough regulation. And you're saying that if you regulate the banks more by boosting capital requirements, it makes the problem worse. So I'd like to have you explain that. Secondly, what's happening with growth forecasts for United States and Europe and exchange rates? It seems to me we've got exchange rates, the dollar and the euro, both headed down. It's almost like a who's ugliest contest.
Thank you. Here, please.
Hi, my name is Asuka. I work with Mr. Lyndon LaRouche. I just have a general question. You know, some people believe in make-believe, you know. Like, you know, some people believe in Santa Claus, some people believe in euro, but, you know, we are all adult here, right? Is there anybody who believes in Santa Claus here? Right? All right. He's dead. All right. Anybody? Euro? What? Anybody believes in euro? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask.
In the back over there, please. There's a person over there. Oh, here. And then here.
Dieter Detke, Georgetown University. First, I'd like to say Europe is not a basket case. It's not an economic basket case, as we have seen in the various crises, right? The issue is still reform in individual states. That needs to be determined. Do we have the capacity, or do these states have the capacity to do the necessary reforms? Spain, Portugal, Greece. And we have seen pretty good steps in Spain, in Portugal, and in Greece too. Let's not forget that. So there is enough money around to help if you need it. Down the line, I think there are two issues. National reform, whether you think this is going to happen or not, and B, the long-term solution to the long-term mechanism to help out beyond the present financial stability facility. How is that going to look after 2013?
Thank you, sir.
Yes, Michael Pomerleno of the World Bank. I was listening very carefully, and before I came here, I had
can you stand up so people in the back can see you, please?
I had some strong views, sharing Desmond's point of view. But listening very carefully, I came with the new hypothesis, so bear in mind, because it's something that I'm sort of clarifying to myself, that actually everybody's right, that it is a wrenching, painful process. As analysts, everybody wants a binary black and white finding regarding the prospects of the future. I will advance the hypothesis that what's going on now is actually very healthy because it's a wrenching process toward the new equilibrium that inevitably will be very difficult and time-consuming because solutions will need to be found, such as clearly, part of the solution is inevitable restructuring, such as in Greece, Ireland. But as Yuri said, were you to do this with a sweep overnight, the moral hazard and the lack of extracting true concessions from labor unions, reforms of the labor system, fiscal situation will not happen. And the institutions are too weak to do it overnight. So I'll say you have 2-3 years of agony at which maybe you will come out okay. But
thank you. So don't feel that you need to answer to every single question, but highlight the points that you would like to discuss. Please be brief so we can have another chance of going around the room. Let's start here.
Okay. On China, I said Asia, but a good fair bit of Asia is China. And yes, you mentioned the need for exchange rate appreciation to basically facilitate the rebalancing process, have more demand in China. I think the most, if you look at what we're forecasting for domestic demand in China now relative to before the crisis, the growth rate is high, but not higher than before the crisis. Obviously, demand growth in the U.S. is lower than before the crisis, and therefore world growth is lower, and that, in the end, is also impacting China. So our view is you need more domestic demand growth. Now that, with the exchange rate alone, you know, you're not going to get very far. So you need other measures. And these measures, you know, steps in the direction of such measures are being taken. I mean, the Chinese government, for example, is expanding social security schemes, social support schemes. And there are other steps that will need to be taken in order to boost domestic demand and reduce very high precautionary savings rates among households, but also through corporate governance reform among companies. So that's what needs to take place. And that should be supported with more market-determined exchange rate. But don't underestimate, the first is the really important part. It's the structural measures to reduce savings in the Chinese economy. And there is movement happening there. And second point, very important, is don't expect miracles overnight. In market exchange rates, measured in market exchanges, Chinese consumption as a share of world consumption is, I mean, don't quote me on it, but it's around 2 to 3% of world GDP. So there's only so much that you can expect off it for the U.S. economy in the short term. But it's to the benefit of China. That's what we believe, and that's why we are advocating this line. Second point was on what's happening to the growth forecast in the U.S., you know, with all this. Let me sum it up, bad news coming in, and that's the only one I'm going to answer. I'll leave the rest for the panel. I mean, it depends what the starting point of your forecast is, right? I mean, ours was for growth in this year on an annual average basis of 2.6% and growth for next year of 2.3%.
Global.
Right? U.S. growth. U.S. growth, you know. We are at the low end of consensus, but still optimistic relative to probably Desmond's view, at least for the world. I'm not sure about the U.S., what has happened since we made a forecast? Well, I mean, Q3 came in somewhat stronger than we expected. Domestic demand growth keeps surprising relative to our forecast on the upside. So there's been some good news. And the second thing that has happened is that we are now going to have a fiscal package, let's say, is under discussion. And previously, in our October forecast, underlying our October forecast was structural fiscal adjustment. So a reduction in cyclically adjusted terms of the fiscal balance, right, of about 1% of GDP. It'll look quite different, I think, depending on what is shaping up. It'll look less detractive, and therefore, you know, that is also something that might be positively impacting growth going ahead. So we'll have a look at it, but I'm not entirely sure, you know, we'll come out lower.
Can I ask you about U.S. growth? As you know, Larry Summers has been saying that if the tax package that is now in front of Congress is not approved, that will unleash, it increases the risk of a double dip recession. Verbatim, he says, Mr. Summers warned that failure to pass the package would materially increase the risk that the economy would stall out and we would have a double dip recession. Do you agree with that?
Let's put it like this. Implicit in our forecast for October was that part of the tax cuts were going to be prolonged, you know. And if that had not happened, you know, the fiscal tightening would have been appreciably higher. Would it have been enough to push the economy into a double dip? I don't know. I mean, you know, it's... but certainly, so
Can I take it from there that you think that QE2, the quantitative easing, the second wave of quantitative easing, is a good thing?
We were positively disposed towards QE2 because we saw inflation falling. Inflation expectations were really coming down, and I don't think the world can afford a U.S. that is stuck in a very low inflation environment and has no room for policy maneuver. So we were positively disposed to it, and the steps that the Fed has announced so far, they are not big steps, right? I mean, we're talking about $600 billion, and then we'll have to see how that evolves as the economy get us perhaps.
Thank you very much, George de Cressin. Phil Sottle.
Well, very briefly on China, it's booming domestically, and I think is adding as much domestic demand to the world as you could ask for realistically. What you could clearly ask the Chinese to do more is move their currency, because I think that has much bigger implications elsewhere. You know, with the Chinese not moving, it either forces more adjustment on other countries like Brazil and Turkey, or constrains other Asian countries from moving, like Korea, and I think just becomes a global problem. But I'm going to spend a little more time addressing Barry's question, which is a very reasonable one. I know there are certain debates you can win and can't win, so I wouldn't expect to win this debate. But I think you actually sort of asked the wrong question in the sense of, first of all, you set it up, I think, a little unfairly. I mean, what we had happening in the global economy was a set of collective mistakes made all around. And the banks were big in contributing to that, but definitely not alone in the process. But I think what we all misunderstood was how risky the process of maturity transformation was, taking short-term liabilities and turning them into longer-term claims. That process turns out, in the modern global financial system, to be a lot more risky than anyone realized 2.5 years ago. And we've had, in that sense, a major regime shift in the global system amongst banks, investors, regulators, supervisors. We're all learning, rating agencies, etc. And that's producing some pretty massive behavioral changes, and we tend to lump them all under the phrase of deleveraging. But I think if you add to those natural pressures underway by ramping up requirements that, in a sense, exacerbate and intensify these forces that are already underway, you're just going to make the adjustment outcome that much more painful. I mean, if you could go... Another way of putting it is if you could go back, and I said this in January here at this, I think in the same room, if you could go back to 2003 and 2004 and rerun time, you'd want to do these things. You'd want to ramp up capital requirements and liquidity requirements to stop all those stupid things that happened in 04, 05, and 06 from happening. But we can't do that. They happened. We have to accept that. You know, people have taken their losses and moved on. What would be really foolish, however, and I fear it's being done, is to kind of steal defeat from the jaws of victory by intensifying the pressures for deleveraging and financial adjustment by aggressive reforms. Now, the irony is we could actually be doing two bad things here, because by focusing so many of the adjustments on, frankly, institutions that are already adjusting fast, we could actually be neglecting some of those institutions I mentioned earlier, which are the booming, rapidly growing institutions in the emerging economies. Put another way, I have no doubt that the next major global banking crisis, and there will be one, the next major global banking crisis is going to come in the emerging market banking system, because that's where a lot of the very aggressive, hectic lending is happening at the moment. And that's really where we should focus our regulatory reform efforts, I think.
Mm. Thank you, Phil. Hans?
On China, I see the focus on the exchange rate as a way to rebalance, as a way to increase their domestic demand, as an example that the focus in a lot of the policy debate is completely wrong at the moment.
In what way?
In what way? If you look at China's import volumes, they are at the moment 60% above what they were before the crisis, July 2008. Their export volumes are 12% above. The 60% is 60. So indeed, as Phil said, China is doing more than you can expect from China, despite the fact that they... have fixed their exchange rate. You see a similar kind of pattern in a country like Brazil that had a sharp appreciation, but that pattern in Brazil is much less extreme. So to argue now that the problem is that there is not enough domestic demand in China and that you have to move their exchange rate is completely misguided, I think. And also the rebalancing at the moment is no longer the issue. And the big danger is that by trying to get these short-term gains in high-income countries by moving the exchange rate in developing countries actually kills the drivers of the growth in the global economy at the moment, and that is in the developing world. And I would argue that actually the developing countries are much more the drivers of global growth than the banks that you're pushing as the ones that should be strong. Secondly, on Europe, I think the shift to the issue of the competitiveness of the European economies, especially in the periphery, is exactly the right one. The issue at the moment is not just the vulnerability in the banking sector. It is not the the fiscal situation. It is the big question, can you get the those economies become competitive again, which is difficult because they are in the euro. It's exactly the same in some of the Central and Eastern European countries. It is not so much just their current fiscal situation. It is not the financial market. It is the big question, what measures can be taken to make those economies competitive again? And again, I'm repeating myself, but it is a shift from emergency response to crisis situation to structural reforms.
Thank you, Hans. Desmond.
I deliberately avoided China because I didn't want the conversation to get pessimistic. China, there are really two issues with China that I would see is that first, there are very clear signs that China's overheating, you know, both in terms of a property market boom as well as inflation picking up, which means that they're going to be slowing aggregate demand down because they're very fearful of inflation. The more important point of China is by not moving their exchange rate at a time that both the United States and Europe are going to have very high employment is a very dangerous situation for the global economy in that we could be on our way to real trade war between the United States and China, and Europe would join in that. So, you know, I think that China being very stubborn on this exchange rate issue is a huge risk to the global economy. Just in terms of Europe, you know, I don't want to classify Europe as a basket case, even though it does remind me of many emerging market countries that I used to work on. But the issue is that they fatally flawed right now because they've allowed imbalances to develop of monumental proportions. So when you see, for instance, like Greece has got in 2009 a public deficit, a budget deficit of 15% of GDP, Ireland 12%, you know, if you exclude the support to the banks. In a fixed exchange rate system, there's no precedent of making the kind of adjustments that the IMF is requiring of these countries, 10 percentage points of GDP in a single year in Greece, 4% in Ireland, in an economy that is deep in recession already. To expect that those economies are going to begin recovering anytime soon is just not on the cards. When these economies go into deeper recessions, what occurs is it erodes the tax base. Then they find that they're missing the targets. You're already seeing that in Greece. They're not collecting the tax revenues that they thought. It means you've got to have another round of budget tightening. You know, so if you want these countries to go the way in which Latvia's gone, you know, the IMF has led them down the path where Latvia's economy is contracted by 20%. You know, this is where we headed in the Greeces and the islands, maybe not to the 20%, but certainly to a level beyond which the political fabric is going to hold together. You know, that is the reason that I just think that this doesn't occur. The IMF should have known a lot better, you know, probably does know a lot better, that you can't solve these problems without both a debt restructuring and a devaluation of the currency. You know, it's a difficult situation for them to do because if the Greeces and the islands do that, you've got a full-blown banking crisis in Europe. So, you know, the inclination of policymakers is let's kick the can forward, let's hope that something turns up. But I've been to this dance a few times before. You know, this was the story with the ERM, this was the story with the Argentine convertibility plan. I am getting old. I wasn't around during the gold standard in the 1930s, but that's what happened to the gold standard too.
Thank you, Desmond. Uri.
Yeah, just very quickly, I agree with Hans and Phil on China, that China has already contributed more to global demand in the last 3 years or so, and hugely more than any other country. I mean, domestic demand in China has gone up above over 40% in the course of the last 3 years or so, whereas it has been essentially stagnant or increased a little in the industrial countries. And that is the heart of the question, is what happens to domestic demand. The currency issue is, in my view, greatly overplayed. the most likely effect of a currency appreciation in China is actually that most of the countries in the world will lose out because of essentially what's called a negative terms of trade effect, or to be kind of more direct, the import prices from China will go up and will not be sufficiently offset for the vast majority of countries, beginning with the United States, by increased exports. This is essentially because the United States does not compete directly with China on export markets, and China imports about four times more from China. United States imports four times more from China than it exports. So for these reasons, the United States is actually a net loser of the exchange rate appreciation itself. What the United States should be concerned about, as should the vast majority of countries in the world, is the continued very high growth of China, as has happened in recent years. This all does not negate the point that it is probably in China's interest to allow an exchange rate appreciation, essentially for very similar reasons than the one, but that is in China's interest. The United States has very little interest, in my view, in an exchange rate appreciation in China. Shall I stop? Yeah, okay.
Finish the phrase.
I finished the phrase. Yeah.
I did put Jorg on the spot asking him about quantitative easing too, and about the notion that without the tax package there will be a double dip. And I want each one of you to answer the question. And it depends is not as allowable as an answer. So you cannot say it depends. Do you think that a tax package is indispensable to avoid a double dip recession? First question. Second question, do you think that quantitative easing is what's needed now and is welcome? Is it something that you support?
Well, I'll answer the first one first. Yes, I think the Fed needed to do something, as much as anything, to stop the deflation spiral developing, but also related to that, obviously, to stimulate growth. With the fiscal package, I just think it's hilarious that, you know, it's a month and we had the Republicans coming in saying we're going to do a tremendous job to reduce the deficit. 1 month on, we're $800 billion higher. So, you know, there's a certain quirkiness there. But I think I pick up on this notion that you can stimulate in the near term, but you also need to give a convincing sign of medium-term adjustment. And I think Obama's proposals in the last 24 hours are an important step in that direction.
Thank you. Hans, quickly.
I think it's not the size of the tax package, but the character of it. I think it's way too general, and as a result of that, you're wasting a lot of money. The last two quarters in the U.S., domestic demand was growing at 4 or 5%. That was pretty healthy. But GDP was not growing because a lot was leaked through the imports. The problem in the United States in terms of unemployment is really concentrated in certain sectors, and you need much more focused and targeted fiscal policies to address that. This very strong.
And quantitative easing?
Quantitative easing.
I think looking from the perspective of developing countries, that's a dangerous one, and they have to be very careful.
Of the exchange rate?
Because it creates exchange rate pressures that are difficult to...
Only if EM countries want to peg against the dollar. I mean, this is an EM country choice.
No, but look at countries like Brazil, look at countries like South Africa. They had to absorb an enormous appreciation.
Because the rest of the EM refuses to appreciate.
But there are dangers associated with appreciation as well.
Yeah.
Thank you. Desmond. Like two questions.
Could you say what the questions are?
The question is, Larry Summers right in saying that without the tax package, the risks of a double dip in the United States are materially higher? And the second is quantitative easing too, a good thing or not?
Yeah, I certainly think that you need to maintain a lot of stimulus for the United States economy. The United States economy looks like it's very weak, that the many headwinds, the United States is at risk of really going into double dip on its own. But if you take my view as to what's going to occur in Europe, the United States should be bracing for a shock coming from Europe, because if we do get a problem in the European banking system, it's going to be very similar to what occurred in the United States financial system. This is going to reverberate throughout the world. You're going to get risk aversion occurring, so that the United States is going to get hit by another shock. Just on the issue of quantitative easing, you know, I think that quantitative easing could have been done well, but it was really poorly handled, you know, because if you look at the 10-year interest rates, you know, the objective of quantitative easing, at least my understanding of quantitative easing, was to get long-term interest rates down. When Bernanke started talking about quantitative easing, the 10-year rate was below 2.5%. Today it's more at something like 3.2%. So they've really bungled the way, you know, because what they've done is they've done it in a way that is half-hearted. There's not real commitment to it on the one side. What they've also done is they've kindled fears in the market that we're on the way to monetizing the public debt, and therefore, you know, you better get out of long-term bonds very quickly. So I think that they've really made a mess on quantitative easing, much the same way as they made a mess of the fiscal stimulus.
You want to make a brief point about...
Just a brief point on long-term interest rates. They've gone up globally. One has to look at that. That's important. And in fact, it used to be that the U.S. interest rate was long-term interest rate was appreciably higher than that of Germany and France. They have now come closer together. So in a sense, the rise in interest rates has been less in the U.S. than it has been elsewhere. And I think it partly reflects some changes that have taken place in the economy. And so I don't think that militates against, for quantitative easing having not been effective.
You know. Thank you, George. Uri, there are two questions.
Yes, I think that Summers is right. Essentially, because no tax package means 2% additional taxes in the United States next year, on top of the withdrawal of fiscal stimulus, which is already built into current plans, existing plans. So that's about a 3% fiscal hit in the United States against the background of all sorts of risks. So a literal interpretation of what Summers is saying, I would agree with, which basically presumes no compromise. Okay. On the quantitative easing, I have very serious doubts about quantitative easing. The doubts were expressed by many, and they took two forms. Number one, would the Fed buying government bonds have a significant effect on long-term interest rates? And number two, if there was some effect on long-term interest rates, given that they are already low or were already low, would they have a significant effect on aggregate demand? Well, the second question we don't have to answer because the answer to the first question is that long-term interest rates have gone up. Now, Jörg is right in saying that they've gone up in other countries as well. But, you know, what are the reasons that they went up in other countries? I mean, they've gone up in Europe because of the European debt crisis. If they've gone up because people are expecting a global recovery, then maybe I didn't need the quantitative easing in the first place. And and there are very serious risks associated with this continued massive liquidity going into emerging markets. Finally, let me say, in response to Phil, when he says, why don't they let the currency appreciate? Well, they don't let the currency appreciate because they've had huge real exchange rate revaluations. In the case of Brazil, the real exchange rate has revalued something like 20-25% since the crisis began. And these real exchange rate revaluations can be turned around very, very quickly and in a very hard landing in a situation where the world economy changes.
Phil, you wanted to react quickly to that?
I think the Fed got it wrong when it thought the way QE worked was by lowering real interest, long-term rates. No, the way QE works is increasing confidence in the recovery. And actually, if that really works, it actually raises long-term interest rates. The trick here, the benchmark, is the stock market. The stock market's up 15% since the Fed undertook this. So I think the easing of financial conditions broadly that's been brought about is an important ingredient telling you that QE is actually working here.
We just have 5 minutes, and unfortunately I don't have time to go through the audience again, but I want to finish with asking you a very pointed question. Each one of you, I want to know if you think that 3 years from now, in 2013, there will be less countries using the euro as its currency than today.
Oh, that's too easy a question.
What do you think?
Can we have more?
Less countries, you say?
Yeah.
No, none, not less.
No, Phil.
More.
More countries.
Okay. Well, there's one already just about to join, right, exactly. So that's easy.
More countries.
Not less.
Not less.
I think that's a trick question because I'm not sure that the euro is going to be around in 3 years.
What did you say, sir?
I think it's a trick question because I'm not sure that the euro is going to be around in 3 years.
Uri?
I think they're going to be more, but I hope they're going to be less.
You figure that out.
These are the 2011 global economic outlook, the euro crisis, currency tensions, and recovery. That was the subject of our conversation today. As you saw, we dealt with that and much more. Please join me in thanking Hans Timmer, George de Cressan, Philly Suttle, Desmond Lachman, and Uri Dadouche.